Okay, Mr. Wise, now, where were you when you heard the news that the war was over?
We were still in combat, actually, in northwest Germany. By that time, there was very little resistance, but there were some German units around of young kids and old men, and we had just liberated a small concentration camp in Ludwigslust, Germany. It wasn't one of the big ones, but scary thing to see those poor guys in their striped uniforms starving to death and everything. And so we were there. We were real happy with it, because we'd been shot at enough, and we were ready to do something different.
And how did you feel about how the war ended?
Well, we were happy till, as they say, till the conference that gave most of it to Russia. You know, that there never should have been a Cold War, because Churchill and Roosevelt should have stood up to Stalin and got him out of the Balkan states and out of Hungary and Czechoslovakia, back, should have pushed him back to pre-war divisions of states. And but they didn't, and so the Cold War developed because the Russians moved in and wouldn't get out.
And what were your expectations once the war ended?
Get home.
Get home. Get home. That brings us into the next question.
Yeah.
What was the trip home like?
It was much better than going over. I went over in a 150-ship convoy from New York. It took us 17 days because we had to go by the slowest ship in the convoy, which was 5-knot oil tankers. Their top speed was 5 knots. We came home as a division. The 82nd Division marched onto the Queen Mary and came home as a division in 5 days. We got to ride in luxury, and we had 2 good meals a day and food in between. And I might add that when I went over the 17, I was airsick for 12 days. I mean, seasick. I was seasick for 12 days.
Now, was that a direct trip home? Or
oh, yeah. We went home, and New York celebrated. We got off the ship down at the Battery end of Manhattan, and combat helmets and carried rifles, and we marched up Fifth Avenue to 125th, from 0 to 125th Street, crossed Central Park, came down to Central Park, and got on boats in the Hudson River and went down to a camp in New Jersey. Well, then we left for home. But the entire division marched as a unit up Fifth Avenue.
I'll bet that was quite a sight.
It was quite a sight. They, I've got a picture in here. I'll show you afterwards.
And you obviously knew your wife Harriet before you ever left for the military and whatnot. What were your expectations about going home, and how did the war affect your deciding to get married fairly quickly after?
We had met 2 years before I left, and we decided that we wanted to get married. But going in as a second lieutenant, Army platoon leader, we decided to wait, to get, rather than get married and leave a widow here. And so we got back January of 46 and got married February 46.
And you say leave a widow here. I mean, it was that point blank for guys leaving, wasn't it?
A lot of them did. And so I just, I didn't want to not come back. This way, we were pretty sure that we wanted to get married and spend our lives together, and we have. We just went by 59 years in February.
So, congratulations.
And we're still together and still happy.
And how did you feel about leaving your friends, the people that you had grown fairly close to?
There was about 10 or 15 real close buddies, or the battalion I served with. And we got pretty close. We lost a lot of people out of my high school graduation class. In fact, we had lost several before I left. One of the first ones was a big Butte football player named Naranchi, Iso Naranchi, was killed at that Kasserine Pass battle in North Africa, which was the first American battle that they talk about in the Patton Show. And several of them were killed early. So that's another reason we didn't want to get married, because I didn't want to get married before we left.
Yeah. And have you kept in contact with any of these people?
Not very many. Several of them have died that I know of. I have one here in town, Scotty McLeod, who was an infantry officer, and he was our best man when we got married, and he's still here, surviving. So. But there weren't very many Montana people in my unit. And a lot of them were the southern guys that I just didn't get to see afterwards. So I'm not in contact with any of them anymore.
Okay. What was the absolute first thing you did when you got home, Ray?
Called Harriet.
What'd you say to her, if you don't mind me asking?
Just said, I'll be home on the 7th. And called from... I think it was New Jersey, Fort Dix or someplace in New Jersey. And I said, tell your mother that I'm ready to get married. So we got married February 16th.
I'm sure Harriet was on your mind quite a bit.
Oh, you bet. We wrote letters, but in those days it took two or three weeks to get a letter back and forth. And I think I called... It seemed like I got through to my folks. My folks were living in Great Falls, and I got through to them. I don't think I ever did catch Harriet. When I left for the service, she got she stayed in Missoula, graduated in 45. And when, at that time, we were not scheduled to come home, so she got a scholarship to Stanford for its graduate school. And it was hard to catch. I don't know that I ever did call her.
How did people in general react to you returning home?
Oh, they were happy to see you, because, at that time, there weren't too many families that were affected by somebody.
Yeah.
Killed, wounded, injured. So we were all happy to be back, and everybody was happy to have us.
Did you find your community changed at all while you were gone?
Not that much. Of course, I was from Great Falls, and when we were going together before I left, every time Harriet went to Great Falls, the wind was blowing 40 miles an hour, and when we got ready to get married, she said, I'll live anywhere you want except Great Falls. So we came to Billings, and... I really didn't live in Great Falls after I got back.
Okay. Now, I had asked you a question earlier about how military life had differed from your civilian life. Sometimes it changes, Ray, as far as going from military life back to civilian life. How was it different this go around?
Not too much. Harriet describes going from civilian to military and saying that I left home a young man and came home a man. Changed that much.
Yeah.
Because I was 20, I was 22, and I came home a man. And when we got back to civilian life, I was a man instead of a boy.
What would you say, what was the easiest and what was the most difficult adjustment.
The easiest was to get rid of the uniform and the regimentation. The biggest adjustment probably is fitting into a working schedule, 8 to 5.
Yeah. And what benefits did you receive from your military service, and how did you use them?
Well, I was, when I got back, a good friend of Harriet's folks had Industrial Equipment Company here. It was a industrial equipment, tractors and loaders and things like that. And he had been a war ace in World War One, and he hired me at $200 a month. And this was 1946, and the government paid $100 of it for the first year. And I had kept my GI insurance. You know, we had GI insurance that cost us $10,000 and cost us about $10 or $15 a month. And when we got out, we got a chance to convert it to whole life at no charge, and the premiums stayed about the same. I still have those. I've got $10,000 coverage. I pay about $250 a year premiums, and I get back about $350 in dividends. The death rate on World War II GIs was much better than the insurance actuary said it would be. So a lot of this is return premiums.
Okay.
That because the GIs have lived longer, and they've I make about $125 a year on my $10,000 GI life insurance. But those are the only two things that I only government things I had. I've been fortunate; they didn't have any. You know, my Purple Heart didn't. I'm not disabled or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So. What about the war made the biggest impact on you?
Well, it I realize that there's a world out there.
Yeah.
And there, people are different around the world, and still they're the same around the world.
Yeah.
And it settled me down. I was ready to get married, have a family. We have two kids, and fortunately they are healthy and successful. And so, but main thing, it converted from a boy to a man.
And how would you sum up your service? Would it kind of be that? Just
The old saying, I wouldn't trade it for $1 million, and I wouldn't go back for $1 million. Although I read, you know, the 82nd is still active division. They're in Iraq, off and on. And sometimes I'll see, they'll show them going out on patrol or something active over there, and I'd like to be with them, actually.
Really?
I would. But at the same time, I'd be scared to death if,
yeah,
if I did. And I, of course, I'm not in physical shape to do it now, but there's something about...
Is that nostalgia?
Yeah, there's something about a combat unit that you don't forget. And one of the scary things, we have a cabin up East Rosebud Lake, and the forest fire in 96, we lost the cabin, but before the fire, we gathered, the Forest Service came up every day and give us, we did, all the cabin owners would meet, and they'd tell us, bring us up to date. It was like being called in before you go on a raid or something, planning. Yeah, some of those ideas, I remember, you know, the officers getting together and saying, well, tomorrow we're going to go attack Laurel or something, or whatever, this is the plan. And those Forest Service guys in their yellow Forest Service slickers and things, and almost like being back in the military.
Well, there's a phrase that's been coined numerous times throughout history, and it's the calm before the storm.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you, Ray?
Well, it when you go into a planning session, say, you know, you're going to move out to attack tomorrow. You go in and they've got all the maps, and Company A is going to do this, Company B is going to do this, Company C is going to do this, and and we're going to end up here. And you go through all of it. Then you go, said, we're going to attack tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock or whenever. And you go back and they say, go get some sleep. And you don't. So you try to stretch out, try to get some rest. But you're going through your mind what's going to happen. And there is a calm before the storm. And then the first time you go, get started, you forget about everything. You know, it's just what's happening. And the thing that most people don't, who have not been in combat, don't realize the terror, the noise, and the things that go wrong. Murphy's Law is written for the Army, because if anything that can go wrong usually does.
How would you say, Ray, that your service time affected your attitudes and ethics in the business world?
It showed me that everybody's pretty much equal. And that I was a banker for 29 years, and if you meet somebody square, that they'll be square with you, and no matter who they are. And I think that's the main thing.
And would you, I suppose this is probably somewhat of a past history question also, but would you encourage, or have you encouraged family members to join the military? Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think you could solve a lot of the young people's problems, especially in the big cities with gangs and stuff, required military service. I'm all for it.
What kind of duration do you think?
Is that like 1 or 2 years? But can you imagine I try to imagine all these young kids growing up in Chicago and Los Angeles and New York in the ghetto situation on the street, tough. They don't know how to get out of there. Get them out of there for a couple of years and let them see what the rest of the world's doing. I think you'd save a lot of those kids that are going to be lost because they can't get out.
Well, and like you said, it can be the transformation for someone from a young man into a man.
Yeah, just to get them out, and because they, you know, a lot of those kids never get out of the neighborhoods. White kids, black kids, Puerto Rican kids, or anything, no matter what their ethnicity is, they don't have a chance. They're going to end up in problems. But at least if you could get them out of there for a year or two, show them what the rest of the world's about, that some of them are going to make it out.
How do you feel, Ray, about Hollywood's portrayal of the war?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I think the present war is being reported terribly. The Iraq situation in Afghanistan, because they're only showing the stuff that goes wrong.
Yeah.
They're not showing the constructive. We had a young fellow get back from Iraq out of our church, and he said they built a school over there. He's in an engineering group or something. That they fixed one school up and they repaired another one. And the media doesn't cover things like that. So, but I think World War II, you know, there wasn't that much intrigue that was not covered.
As far as movies that have been made nowadays, like we had discussed Saving Private Ryan, what do you think of their portrayal? And if they were to grasp one missing element, what would it be and why?
It was pretty good. It's as close to combat conditions as you can do in a movie.
And that's Saving Private Ryan.
And it was a good portrayal of a good officer doing a good job and taking care of his men. And it's about as much as you could do. It didn't show the units working like a battalion or a company, squads, things like that. It was just one squad with his working together. But I thought it was very good, and I thought Patton was done very well. But Patton's a strange man, and it showed that that there are a lot of generals and officers that are complicated people. He wrote poetry, and always claimed that he'd been there when for the Battle of Carthage. You know, he went. I remember you don't remember that, and it struck me that when they're in North Africa, he wants to go see the battle. And tells the driver of the battles that way, says, let's go this way. He goes over to some place where the Carthaginians were beaten by the Romans in 1092 or whatever. And he says, I was there. Now, this is Patton. And I think the movies have tried, some of them are terrible.
Yeah.
The Battle of the Bulge, which I was in, was filmed in Spain. And out in the open plains, and there aren't any open plains in Belgium, but the story was good. It worked out, but it wasn't accurate at all. They did have some things right. The assassination of Malmedy, they showed where the Germans killed about 30 paratroopers, shot them in the ditch and things like that, but it's hard to do. You have to make a movie that you can't make a movie that is accurate.
Well, to kind of end this, Ray, if you could possess one Polaroid shot, one picture that sums up your military experience, what would it be of and why?
Something like this picture here in Berlin when it was all over and things were settled and we got our job done, that and the march up Fifth Avenue with the division coming home, something like that.
Okay.
You know, battlefield pictures, they're scary, and most of them are they're accurate, but it's just one little shot. You can't get the overall event in a picture.
And this picture Mr. Wise is talking about is a picture of him at age
25. Yeah, taken in Berlin by a professional German photographer.
In his Class A uniform?
Mm-hmm. Class A uniform.
All right. Well, I thank you for your time, Mr. Wise. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.